The title of today's sermon is Shepherds and Wolves, be given by our pastor, Mr. Robert Barrett.
Thank you again, Dan, and greetings to those in the cybercast that may just be tuning in. We do sometimes have that happen, that people tune in just in time for the sermon itself. I know there's some who are not even able to listen to the whole sermon. They listen for as much as they can, and then they have other places to go, other church services to attend, perhaps. I once saw an actual film of a real tragedy that has stuck with me. Sometimes these things do. It's not a very nice story. It's a very sad story. But it was on the Discovery Channel, and it was the picture of what was occurring with this little warthog family in Africa. And warthogs are ugly creatures. They look terrible. But they're pretty fast moving, you know, a little sort of a pig animal. This warthog mother was just gaily trotting along with these little brood of six little warthogs, their tails all up in the air, and they were just having a wonderful life. When they were being spotted then by a pack of African wild dogs. Now, the African wild dogs are not huge animals, but they're fierce, and they hunt in packs. They're about the size of a coyote, I guess, a coyote. They hunt in packs, and these dogs were hungry. And so on this Discovery Channel film, they showed how the dogs came and attacked this little family, and how the mother warthog ran frantically from side to side to protect her little ones. And every time a dog would come from one side, she'd chase the dog, and another dog would come from the other side. And soon dogs began picking off one or two of the little warthogs. And as the warthogs were getting picked off, there were three left, and they were trying to stay with the mother. So as the mother ran, the little warthogs were running behind her to get her, keep her protection, but they couldn't keep up with the mother. So in the end, she lost all six of her little warthogs. And the wild African dogs took all of them and killed them and ate them. And that is, of course, nature and the way that it runs. It's a tragic story, and we know it happens in nature, but it left an impact on me, and I was struck by the frantic efforts of the mother. You know, when you think about the responsibility that a mother has like that, and to see that happening. Now, for warthogs, of course, she would have forgotten about those little ones in a couple of days' time, and that's the way God made them too. But we don't, as human beings, we'd never forget when things like that happen in our lives. And that's one of the reasons when I think of Job, I think of an awesome man. Can you imagine having all 10 of your children brought to you dead and you stay normal? You know, it's a frightening thought. My grandmother on my father's side had 9 children, and 5 of them died within about a 2 or 3 month span of time of dysentery of some type that children got in Europe at the time. Only 4 stayed alive, and she went out of her mind for 1 year. She just totally lost it for a whole year. And finally, she came to herself and was able to look after her remaining 4 children. But that happened in Europe many times. In every city in Europe, you'll see the ugliest statue in the middle of the city you can possibly imagine. Skulls hanging out and bones there and hands out and all these ugly things. And I asked, well, what would you ever put a statue like that for in the middle of your city? And it's a statue to respect all those who died in the Black Plague and other plagues of Europe. And there were a lot of them. And then, of course, the wars came along, and there were other things that occurred and happened, and people were hurt. We rejoice when we hear and read of the wonderful stories, of the success stories of God's people, the blessings that are there, and the wonderful futures and opportunities, as we read about the Belrup family. It's a wonderful thing. But, you know, I've been a minister now for 33 years in God's church, and I haven't seen that everyone is blessed. I've seen a lot of people, they've all been blessed, but I've seen a lot of people with problems continue in those problems and continue in them sometimes right into the grave. And you know, you sort of get the feeling sometimes that somebody's slipping away and you want to grab them and hold on to them and pull them back, and you can't do it. You just cannot do that. And it's a helpless feeling, a little like that mother warthog, I think. And every minister feels a little bit that way if he truly, in his heart, is a shepherd who cares for God's people. And that is a responsibility that a minister has, to love God's people. That's one of the greatest traits or characteristics, which is God's characteristic. We all should love each other. But a minister ought to be that way more so, and to care for them. And so when you see someone hurting, you sort of want to run and take that hurt away and take that suffering away, just like parents do with their children. They cut their finger and you run over there and you put all kinds of stuff on there so it doesn't hurt anymore. And yet, it's good for the child sometimes to have a cut finger. It's good for them to be hurt a little. They learn that way. But, you know, in our hearts, We don't like to see them hurt. You don't like to see your children hurting or somebody you love hurting. Let's go to the book of 1 Peter so we can have this responsibility etched into our minds. And I am very jealous of the ministry in the sense that it is God's ministry. It's a service that is so great and so mighty in scope that I know I certainly don't deserve to be here. No, nobody really does. But if you're called into the ministry, if that's what you're called to be, then a person needs to use the talents and gifts and abilities God gives to be the best minister possible. And for me, I think those of you who know me, you knew that I wasn't planning on being a minister. I was a graduate from school. I had a very good teaching position. I'd have been retired now with a nice pension, taking cruises in the Mediterranean, like some retired teachers that we met there. But in 1 Peter chapter 5, Peter writes, "The elders who are among you, I exhort." So now here's a minister talking to ministers. Here's an apostle talking to the ministers. "I am a fellow elder and a witness of the sufferings of Christ." So Peter saw it firsthand. Some of them also did who were alive, but some of them didn't as they came newly on board as ministers. "And I'm a partaker of the glory that will be revealed." And that's why we're here. That's what tomorrow is all about, Pentecost and the return of Jesus Christ, the glory that will be revealed in the children of God, in the people of God, as God draws them and calls them. And he goes on to say in verse 2, "Then to the elders, to those who are ordained, shepherd the flock of God, which is among you. Serve as overseers, not by compulsion, but willingly, not for dishonest gain, but eagerly." I remember talking years ago with a fellow by the name of Dave Biggs, who was with me in Squaw Valley. We were lined up to get this entrance test to see if we could go to Ambassador College. And we were the oldest fellows there. I was 28 years old at the time, 29. And Dave Biggs was, I think, around the same age. And we were here with all these 17-year-olds. You know, we thought we were edging to go away. We didn't really want this. We were edging to go out. But a whole bunch of things happened that I can't explain to you, but I know it happened. I know it did because I lived it. That made me end up going to Ambassador College with my family. And when I was there in Pasadena for this little short visit, I went by the little apartment where we lived for the 2 years with Rick and Dan and Kathy and Carrie, a two-bedroom apartment in which I had built bunk beds and stuck the kids in like rugs to live in the bunk bed conditions there. And lived very poorly, I might admit. You know, after 4 years of going to Ambassador to University of Alberta with two children and the third one born during the time I was there, and then going to Ambassador College for another couple of years a bit later, I knew what poverty meant. And I knew what it meant to live cheaply. You know, we used to have the no-cost meals at least once a week. And then Joan at the time could really do that. Potatoes and sauerkraut basically was what it was. I made the sauerkraut. But, you know, we knew what that all was. So you're supposed to do this willingly. And it was willingly. It was willingly that we went to Ambassador College. It was willingly that we then returned down. I had an offer from Edmonton School Board. Please come back and teach in Joshua Place Composite High School. They wanted me to run the science department. Please come back and do that. And I was going to sign the contract already. And I was told, don't sign it. But in those days, they didn't tell you why. So I didn't sign the contract, and then I was assigned in the ministry in Canada. And I was glad to do that, but that's not why I went to Ambassador College. I didn't go there to be a minister. I went to learn about the Bible. That was my dream. But it goes on saying in verse 3, not as lords over those entrusted to you. So God entrusts people to people. He entrusts people to ministers. And some ministers fall pretty flat on that job. Some ministers fail that job. Some don't do a very good job of it. But if a minister truly loves people, which is, I think, the greatest quality that God looks for in a minister, he will be successful in serving God because he'll put the people first. So you're to be an example, then, to the flock. Now, I've never yet had to go to anybody and say, well, now you've got four children. Well, get a little two-bedroom apartment, build your bunk beds, and stick them all in there. I haven't been told them that. I haven't said to people going to the Feast of Tabernacles, you know, pack your little Volkswagen, take out the back seat, put in your tents and your sleeping bags and your little Volkswagen and travel to California and go to the feast and tent it and do your cooking because you couldn't afford anything else. Some people would rather not go than do that. But we went and we tented down there. We got rained out and froze out and ended up on the floor of Schmitz and the Extra's house. But we learned wonderful lessons there, and most of all, we learned to love each other and appreciate one another. So you're to be an example to the flock, he says, and when the chief shepherd appears, so I'm not the chief shepherd. Boy, it's a comfort to know that. When the chief shepherd does appear, though, you will receive the crown of glory that does not fade away. Now, that crown is something which everybody receives. You receive that as well. But a minister should function as a minister willingly, because God gives additional ability, but he functions. That's his job. It's like somebody with a beautiful voice. You should be singing for the church services or in the choir, because that's your gift. That's your talent. You supply that. Or someone who can just comfort people. Some people got a gift of comforting others. And you should do that. You should be comforting. You should be hugging people who need hugs. I know a lady who's a great hugger. But she said to me, she realizes you can't hug everybody. Just certain ones you got to be careful of. But she is that way. She's warm and she's very friendly. That's her gift. But when I think of that which I've been called to do and the area I've been called to work in, I'm very, very thankful. I'm very grateful. Although it has not made my life easier. You know, I didn't want to live in Germany, didn't want to live in Ottawa, didn't want to live, you know, away from my family. But I had to leave my family and go to Germany for 5 years. I did not want to do any of those things. But I did it because I felt God wanted me to. And furthermore, my brother had cancer in his neck, and I anointed him in 1979, I guess it was, 79, yeah. And I promised God that I'd go wherever he wanted me to go. Just thought I've got to see that he wanted me to go there. And my brother is alive today and healed and well. I'm glad of that too. So you do things sometimes, and sometimes you make promises maybe you shouldn't make, you know, and things like that. But anyways, all of that is part of my own personal experience, and I can only tell you about mine. When I read in the Bible that this ministry is no longer the ministry of Aaron or the Levitical priesthood, but it is the ministry of Melchizedek, the ministry of Jesus Christ, that's a whole different ballgame. Now we're talking about a spiritual ministry rather than a physical one. And that doesn't mean, as some people mistakenly think, oh, well, I'm the minister, I just do spiritual things. No, a minister should be moving chairs too. You know, getting hold of the broom and doing some sweeping or whatever is necessary. You do that. If you want to set an example, you do all of that. Now, Peter goes on to say in verse 8, talking to the ministry, he's talking to me, and he's talking to all of us, of course. But he says in verse 7, I should say, I won't go to verse 6, but because that's what I spoke about at the minister's conference in Cincinnati. Verse 7 says, cast all your cares on him. Cast your cares on Jesus Christ, because he cares for you. You know, I had a beautiful little sign given to me by a close friend that I'll perhaps make and bring along for church services. But the sign says, this is God speaking. I'm in charge today. Don't worry. You know, it says an awful lot, because we do worry. You know, I'm like the mother warthog. You know, I worry, and I shouldn't be worrying. I shouldn't be. And if you do your job and you love people, then you've got to let God do the rest. And he does the rest. And Jesus Christ does the rest. He goes with you where you go. And I can't do that. Maybe it's a good thing. But it says, though, be sober and be vigilant, because your adversary, the devil, walks around like a roaring lion seeking whom he may devour. And the first ones he goes to are ministers. Ministers who get funny ideas, who get a brainwave that, suddenly they, you know, that God's given them the light. It's the end time. Christ is returning next year or whatever. And they've got to tell the whole world. And so now then they discard everybody else. They discard everybody who's praying for them and working with them and cried for them and so on. And they go tootling off on their own. And in fact, try to destroy those who they left behind. It's a terrible thing to see happening. And yet I've seen it happen many times over and over again, and you have too. But Satan is a lion seeking whom he may devour. He's after you. He's after me. He's not after the people who are not God's people in this world. He's got them. He's after those who are God's people. Those are the ones he is after. So if you are in that category, then you're the one he's after. You're supposed to resist him, and I'm supposed to resist him. Steadfast in the faith. Steadfast means you walk a straight, solid line. Someone said about me once, I took it as a compliment. He says, you're like an open book. In other words, what you see is what you get. There's nothing hidden. There's no hidden motives, no agendas. You're like an open book. And I think that's a very good way of describing a person who is a person of God. That doesn't mean that you should be easily fooled and naive and things like that. Sure, you trust people, but you trust people knowing sometimes they're going to let you down. You just accept it. You just accept that and make do. Be steadfast, though, in the face, knowing that the same sufferings are experienced by your brotherhood in the world. And so I know that it's good for God's people sometimes to suffer. I know it's necessary for them to have health problems. I know it's necessary, perhaps, to have financial problems. I know it's necessary sometimes to have, you know, personal problems, interpersonal problems, children who hurt you or disappoint you. You know, all these things are necessary for us because it's a growing trajectory that we are in. We're learning to be God-like. We're learning to be like Jesus Christ. And Jesus Christ suffered to be perfected. So we need to understand that that's going to happen to you and to be in our lives. And then it says in verse 10, but may the God of all grace, who called us to his eternal glory by Jesus Christ, or by Christ Jesus, after you suffered a while, perfect, establish, strengthen, and settle you. I'm sure all of you can look at your lives and list areas in which you've had trials and difficulties. Areas where you've suffered and you've been hurt. All of you, I'm sure, have. And if it's a small list right now, believe me, it'll get bigger. It'll get larger. And one day, it'll end up when you're dying. And that's a big trail to go down, the trail into the valley of the shadow of death. And yet that's a trail that God's people have gone down as well, now for 6,000 years. And you and I may go down that trail before Christ returns. We all hope he'll return before we die, But you know, when you're in my case, 66, God says 70. That's four more years for me. Oh boy, I get a bit nervous, don't you? I'm hoping I'll get some bonus years. Maybe we'll get some bonus years in there. But nevertheless, that's a fact of life. And it's a fact of life that I face often, because when God's people are dying, I'm often with them. I have to spend that time with them and visit them. I hold their hand and encourage them at times. So I've got to look after myself as an individual, spiritually. But I also have a responsibility to each of you. That's what a minister has. A responsibility to each of you. And actually, you've got responsibilities to each other as well. So we all, in a sense, you see, we're all growing to become the leaders, the kings and priests, ultimately, the salvation of this world, ultimately. We're all growing in that direction. The Bible describes us as sheep. But I remember Mr. Herbert Armstrong strongly stating, I know God called you as sheep, but you're not supposed to stay that way, he would say. And we're not, and you're not. You're supposed to become strong, spiritually strong, spiritually mature. Now, not all of us in God's family will be spiritually mature at the same time. But those of you who've been in the church for 35, 38 years, like I have been, and some of you have been, I know that, you're the mature ones. You're the ones whom God's looking to add the cement, the foundation, the strength to the church. So I have pastored the church now for 33 years, God's people. And I've been through times where people have said, oh, Christ is going to return at any given moment now. Don't buy a house. Or if you're going to buy a house, you won't leave it. If you need to leave it, you won't leave it. And all these things were said. I've experienced all of that as well. I ask myself, and I've asked myself for 33 years. How can I help the people I love and care about, God's people, my brethren, who have difficulties in their lives? How can I help those who are sick and not healed? How can I help those that are discouraged and don't see any way out? How can I help those who are paying a penalty for choices they've made a long time ago? Because you see, the choices you make, even as a child, often stay with you the rest of your life. The effect stays with you the rest of your life. Sometimes they're very good choices, and the benefits are there. Sometimes they're not so good choices. And so then you struggle for your life and the rest of your life. Sometimes driving too fast has cost people an accident where they're crippled for life. Just a decision, a momentary decision, which leaves them penalized for the rest of their lives. How do you encourage people like that? How do you talk to people who are suffering in that way? I've wondered that, and I've had to do that many times. And I ask myself, how did the disciples strengthen the brethren? How do you meet with people in caves who are being sought by soldiers and arrested so that they can be put to death? How do you do that? What do you say as a minister, as a pastor? What do you say to people that are suffering in that particular way? And you should be there with them. As a matter of fact, the ministers are the first ones taken. The book of Acts is full of that. Peter's taken, put in jail. Where are the members? They're praying in someone's house, praying for Peter, and afraid that the next knock on the door is going to be soldiers coming after them. But how does Peter then strengthen those people? What does a minister do, and how do you do that? I've asked myself that question for many, many years. Let's go to the book of Hebrews, Actually, when I realized I was going to be in the ministry, I began asking that question because it makes me very nervous. It makes me very nervous to understand the responsibility that's given to a minister. And it makes me nervous to see some ministers lose that responsibility, shed that character that they need to have. So I ask myself, how could I be strong enough to be the first to go if necessary? How can I be the first strong enough if someone's coming knocking on the door, to arrest somebody, say, take me? How can you do that? You know, in England, I think the last Sabbath keepers in England, before they fled to the United States, the last Sabbath keepers were having a Sabbath service just like this. And a knock came on the door. It wasn't even a knock. They kicked the door down. They took the minister out. They hung him. And then they quartered him. They had four horses, one on each arms, two arms and two legs, and tore him to pieces. That was the minister of that little group. And, of course, the group then moved. But they didn't kill everybody that was there. They killed the pastor and the minister. So I asked, they were after Peter. They were after the leaders. Well, how can you be strong in a case like that? We don't live in that conditions today. I know that. We don't live that way at all. Not in Canada. But the day will come, maybe, where we will be living like that. And some of our ministers at this time are living in conditions like that. In some parts of Africa, some parts are very, very safe. Like Ghana is wonderful. But if you're in Nigeria or Kenya or some of those Muslim nations in the north, you know, it's not safe at all. And so we're going to experience these kind of things. And we can say, well, God will protect the ministers. And I always tell everybody, I've got this big angel riding on the hood of my van. You know, and some people say, well, hope he moves over. Let's just see a bit. You know, but I always say that, and I do believe I have protection. I feel it. I feel it when I travel, when I drive, and so on. I felt it in standing in the middle of Los Angeles in a dark street, 1 o'clock in the morning, a place you don't want to be. You shouldn't be. You'd be dumb to be there. But through a whole bunch of bad circumstances, there I stood. You know, and God sent this black man along to encourage me and help me, and he was maybe an angel, I don't know, but he was there, and I had no fear whatsoever. Now, if a taxi would have come by, I'd have grabbed the taxi and got a ride into Pasadena. But I stood there, and it was all right, and I got to where I needed to go. Let's go to Hebrews chapter 11. You know, when I read this years ago, and certainly you've read it too, I don't want to read the first part of it, but, you know, I think of the last part of it. I think of the wonderful blessings that some have. You know, as I've mentioned with Shaquille and Ronnie, you know, it's wonderful to see the young people in the church growing up and being responsible and having the opportunities, just doors opening to them. They take those responsibilities and they move forward in their lives in such a wonderful way. But I'll tell you, brethren, the moment a war comes, all of that stops. I know two young members of the church who were, one was a professor in Split, which was in Kosovo. And when the wars came there, two young men who wouldn't go into the battle had to leave the country. They fled up to Austria. And they were in the church. They couldn't go back. Their careers were interrupted. Their studies were interrupted. That's gone on now for years. But in verse 34, and we've read about all the wonderful things that happened in verse chapter 11 of Hebrews 11. All these things by faith they did that, and God stopped the mouths of lions, and they stood in the big fires, you know, and nothing happened to them. They weren't singed, you know, and various things like that. All these wonderful stories. They are wonderful, and there are blessings. And I've experienced blessings, and you've experienced blessings. And I'm sure you thank God for them every time that they have come. But there's times where God lets you suffer. There's times where God does not take away the pain, does not take away the ache you're facing or the trial you're facing. He allows it to happen. And sometimes you wonder why, but you see, in Hebrews 11, it happened to a lot of people. He said he quenched the violence of the fire in verse 34 of Hebrews 11, escaped the edge of a sword. These are all blessings. Out of weakness, were made strong, like the disciples. When Christ was captured in Gethsemane, they ran, some of them naked. Because other guys grabbed their cloak, they just ran. But they became strong. And that's the responsibility of the ministry. These were ministers, these were apostles. But others, members of the church, were made strong. And you can be made strong too. That's my prayer, that you should be made strong. They became valiant in battle and turned to flight the armies of aliens. Women received their dead raised to life again. That's a wonderful thing. I remember this little girl, 9 years old, in the Ottawa area, who was dying of cancer. She was dying. She was left in the children's ward as the only child there when they built the new hospital because she was dying that night. There's no point in moving her. And I visited her every single day of the last, I think, 2 weeks of her life. But on the Sabbath, which was the day she was going to die, her mother stayed overnight with her in the hospital, about 2:30 in the afternoon, when we were having services, and I'd asked the people to fast and pray for this little girl, she asked for some soup. And she was healed. It was an amazing thing. She's alive today. She's got a girl now of about the same age that she was when she had cancer. So those are wonderful things you remember, and you rejoice over, and you're thankful for. But I've also had to do funerals for people who were not healed. My wife was one of them. So you see, you some have their dead raised to life again, and we're all happy for that. We all rejoice. But some don't. And I ask myself, you know, it's easy to rejoice. It's fun rejoicing with people. What do you do with somebody who has nothing to rejoice over? How do you handle them? You know what most people do? They go away because it's too difficult. It's too painful. You don't know what to say. You're uncomfortable. There's a gift that God gives to comfort people, and we should learn that gift. But it says, others were tortured, not accepting deliverance, that they might obtain a better resurrection. So I ask myself, what do I say to somebody who was being tortured? Maybe hanging beside me. I don't know. Or maybe I'm being tortured too. What do you say to a person like that? How do you encourage them? And what if they're slipping and getting weak? What if they're ready to, you know, give in? You know, there were thousands of people. When I lived in Salzburg, I went up to this big fort, which was a Catholic fortress, where people were tortured. The torture chambers are right there. They'll tell you the whole story if you go up there and see it. But people were put on the rack and tortured until they recanted or repented, and supposedly the souls were saved rather than endure the pain. But of course, then often they'd kill them anyway. Still others had trials of mockings and scourgings and of chains and of imprisonment. How do you encourage a person that experiences that? They were stoned, they were sawn in two, they were tempted, that was Satan, they were slain by the sword, and they wandered about in sheepskins and goatskins, being destitute, afflicted, and tormented. I've never had to do that yet. Some of us lose our jobs, finances are poor, and we're struggling along. But you know, I must say, during the time that I went to university for those 4 years and Ambassador College for the 2 years and the years in between, we just barely began to get ourselves going financially. There was a long span of time that our family was very poor. And I must say that my wife never complained about that. Never once did I remember Joan ever complaining that I didn't provide enough for her and for the family. The boys said to me here not long ago, I guess it was a few years ago, they said, you know, Dad, when we were kids, we didn't realize for all that time that we lived under the poverty level. And they did. But we didn't think about it that way. I never thought about it that way at all. We just got along. We just did what needed to do, and we got along. So some were afflicted, of whom the world was not worthy. They wandered in deserts and mountains and dens and caves, and all of these, having obtained good testimony through faith, did not receive the promise. Maybe the promise of healing. Maybe the promise of blessings, of you know, you can't build barns big enough to bless you, God would say to them. But God has provided something better for us, that they should not be made perfect apart from us. That's you and me at the end time. And all of those people, those wonderful people who endure that kind of suffering, they don't receive any promises. They're asleep. Because God has provided something better for us. So everyone is waiting till the return of Jesus Christ. Now, the one nice thing is that those who have died, that we're reading about here, are going to be the first to be resurrected. So we'll be catching up with all of them if we're alive. So that's a kind of a wonderful blessing. But to be a part of the first resurrection, that's what the Pentecost season is about. That's what this whole feast means. And it's so rich with meaning, which you'll hear about tomorrow and experience in your lives and in your heart. It's so rich with meaning that you have to ask, well, what is it worth then? What should I give up for these blessings? And the answer is, there's nothing you cannot give up. Everything needs to be given up. Your life needs to be given up. Your heart needs to be given up. Your thoughts need to be given up and conformed to the image of Jesus Christ. And that's what we are trying to do. That's why we are here today. In Hebrews chapter 12, going down a couple of verses, verse 5, I'll try to read through here a bit quickly from verse 5 to verse 15. You have forgotten the exhortation which speaks to you as sons. You see, here Paul is talking after these things. He's talking about those in verse 1, 2, and 3 who became weary. Verse 3, it says, lest you become weary and discouraged in your hearts. Well, you know, what do I do when I see a person who is weary and discouraged? How do I treat that person? How do I comfort that person? You know what I want to do? I want to give them a booster shot of some kind. I want to give that person some kind of a strength and encouragement. And sometimes I can't seem to reach them. It's like that mother warthog, you know, she's taking care of these three and the others are being dragged off in another different direction. And you want to become an octopus or whatever, you know, to help everybody, and you can't. And so sometimes there's frustration that I feel personally as a minister over the years. You have forgotten the exhortation which speaks to you as sons. My son, do not despise the chastening of the Lord, nor be discouraged when you are rebuked by him. For whom the Lord loves, he chastens and scourges every son whom he receives. And so every one of us will receive some type of training from God and some type of correction, because we're not perfect. We want to be more God-like. We need all of these things. It's important. So I realize that it's important that I suffer from time to time. And it's important that you suffer from time to time. Whatever God puts in your path, as you follow him, as you walk in Jesus' footsteps, whatever suffering you have to endure, you're doing it for the sake of Jesus Christ, in the name of Jesus Christ, in the name of all that you hope to be, and all that you plan to be, and all that you're striving to be. And for that sake, you're willing to lay down your life if necessary. In 2 Peter, going back now, oh, just a moment, let me stay in Hebrews for just a second longer here. Verse 15. Look carefully, lest anyone fall short of the grace of God, lest a root of bitterness springs up and causes trouble, and by this many become defiled. So you become defiled sometimes by a root of bitterness that you have allowed to be inside of you. Have you ever had a reason to have a root of bitterness? I think we all have. I think I have. I still ask myself, you know, till this day, which is almost 20 years after Joan's death, why at 45 years of age would a woman like that just be allowed to die who served God so faithfully? I haven't got any answer for it. You know, or my daughter Carrie, who is not well, I ask the same thing. I prayed for that girl for all of her life, and I ask, why is she not made well and healed? Why do I have to carry this load while I carry it? I carry it gladly. And you do too, because we need to be carrying loads. It strengthens us. It makes you strong when you're holding something and carrying something. Jump down to verse 22. See, I read these things, then I read also verse 22. You have come to Mount Zion, to the city of the living God, the heavenly Jerusalem, to an innumerable company of angels. And we don't see them. And sometimes that picture isn't clear in our minds. The direction that we're going in and the path that we're striving to follow is not always clear in our minds. But that's what God says. You've come to that. You've come to the General Assembly and the Church of the Firstborn who are registered in heaven. I mean, God's the one who registers you. Put your name down. All the angels watch him do that. He says, this is my child. This is my son. This is my daughter. And your name is put down by God's hand in his book. And you come then to this registry, to God, the judge of all, to the spirits of just men who are made perfect through whatever we suffer. You know, you learn to appreciate and be thankful for what you have when you don't have a lot of things. When you don't have, you know, a menu to eat, a menu of foods to eat, then you're thankful for sauerkraut and potatoes. But it's amazing how if you have children and you just give them everything, you know, you're their servant. What do you want to eat? You want scrambled eggs? Make your scrambled eggs. You want Kraft dinner? Make your Kraft dinner. What do you want to eat? I'll make it for you. You're the cook, the chef, and everything for your child. You look at the spoiled brat of a child. My mother never once in my life asked me what I'd like to eat. She says, it's supper time. If you don't want to eat, that's all right. It's supper time. And sometimes that supper was terrible. I had a grandmother that went to the concentration camps of Europe. She knew how to cook soup with nothing. I don't know what she had in it, but what it was terrible. She called it potato soup. She used to pick up the rotten potato peels from the army camp and make soup out of it. I believe she did the same in Leicester. It sure tasted bad. Anyways, but we weren't asked. We were just said, it's supper time. You know, my mother would save up the bread, and that was dried up old crusts of bread. She'd save it up, and we didn't know she saved it up. One day, when supper time comes, here we get a bowl of bread, dried bread that was broken up. She'd pour coffee on it. She said, that's supper. Didn't ask you, would you like it? Or what kind of pudding would you like? What kind of yogurt would you like? I've got 15 different varieties for you, or something like that. I never knew what that was. Verse 24, to Jesus, the mediator of the new covenant, to the blood of sprinkling that speaks better than things than that of Abel. See that you do not refuse him who speaks. For if they did not escape who refused him who spoke on the earth, how much more shall we not escape if we turn away from him who speaks from heaven? What a great thing to contemplate and think about. And I must say that my life as a child was such a blessing. I wish everybody could have it. I wish you could live that way. We didn't have any running water in the house, didn't have inside toilets. You know, it was pretty cold at times over there. And we had a radio that crackled, no TV, things like that. Never heard of those kind of things, but I could play hockey. I could go out in the bush. I could climb trees. You know, I could cross-country ski. We could throw rocks. We could float little boats down in the streams in the springtime. We found 1,000 things to do. Today, children have got everything, and they're bored. It's amazing. Bored. I never heard of that word when I was a child. And it hasn't hurt me a bit, that pain that I went through. Let's go back to 2 Peter now then. You see, because Peter reflects, I think, sometimes the things that I feel as a minister and that we all feel. So that's why I've entitled this sermon, Shepherds and Wolves. In chapter 2, in verse 1, 2, and 3, chapter 2 of 2 Peter, he says, "There were also false prophets among the people, wolves in sheep's clothing." He says, "As there will be false teachers among you who will secretly bring in destructive heresies, denying the Lord who bought them and bring on themselves swift destruction." There's lots of ways of denying the Lord that bought you. One of the ways is doing away with sin. God says, you know, Christ died for the sins of this world. If somebody stands up and says, "Well, that's not a sin anymore. That's not a sin anymore. Cancel it. If you can't, commandments don't count. You can't sin. A born-again Christian can't sin." Well, then you're denying Jesus Christ. That's why he died. Because we've all sinned. And I get on my knees every day to ask God's forgiveness for the things that I don't do, forget to do, misdoing, misthinking, or whatever, every single day. And I'm sure you do the same. The converted person does that. So we all do that. It says, though, in verse 2, and that's what worries me, "Many will follow their destructive ways, because of whom the way of truth will be blasphemed." And it saddens me always that there are always some that do follow. It seems everybody that blows a trumpet or a horn, there's those that seem to drift towards it. "By covetousness they will exploit you with deceptive words." Like a friend gave me your name and thought you'd like this magazine. Those are deceptive, lying, cheating words. Ungodly, satanic words. Because that's not in a person's heart or mind at all. And I don't know, the situation over there. And in fact, I'm just saying that the concept is not right. "For a long time their judgment has not been made idle, and their destruction does not slumber. For if God did not spare the angels who sinned but cast them down to hell and delivered them into chains and darkness to be reserved for judgment, and did not spare the ancient world but saved Noah of the eight," he goes on saying that we obviously know then that God is in charge. He's the chief shepherd. He's my shepherd. And he's your shepherd. He's my God. And he's your God. He's our Father. That's why Jesus said you start praying, "Father," and not "my Father in heaven," but "our Father." Now, we do pray "my Father" sometimes, but generally speaking, we include one another in our prayers. So I do get very concerned for God's people, and I do feel very helpless at times. You know, I look at the book of John, which is where Jesus was telling us about being a shepherd. Let's look there for a moment in John chapter 10. I suppose the concern is something you can't help but have. And as I said, I'd have been a far wealthier man if I wouldn't have been in the ministry. So that's not why I'm in the ministry. It's not why I came in the ministry in the first place. And as far as retirement is concerned, sadly enough, Mr. Armstrong didn't believe any minister should ever retire. You retire, you carry you out feet first. And that's a situation in the United States, you know, that there was not a single step made towards a pension plan for any minister. There wasn't any pension plan. They have no pensions. In Canada, we have at least got the Canadian pension plan, which helps a little bit. But American ministers, some of them have nothing. And some people think, well, they got big salaries. No, they didn't. No, they didn't. The salary of a minister is roughly the salary of a school teacher. But anyway, in John chapter 10 and verse 7, Jesus said to them again, and he's speaking now to the disciples. He's talking to those who understand. I'm trying to help him understand more fully. He says, "Most assuredly I say to you, I am the door of the sheep." Christ is the door. He is the chief shepherd of the sheep. And he calls his people sheep. But he calls others in the world sheep too. Everybody, in a sense, becomes the sheep of God. "All who ever came before me are thieves and robbers, but the sheep did not hear them. I am the door. When he says all that came before me, he's talking about false ministers and false prophets who were thieves and robbers. But the sheep did not hear them. I am the door. If anyone enters by me, he will be saved and will go in and out and find pasture. The thief does not come except to steal and to kill and to destroy. I have come that they may have life, that they may have it more abundantly. That ought to be the direction of the ministry. That's why I rejoice with the Malroops and others who are blessed. But I know that one day I or someone like me will hold their hands when those blessings seem to have evaporated. And I don't wish them any ill to anybody, any of God's people. I wish nothing but blessings. But it's wonderful to see a happy family and a happy person and someone feeling completely, you know, blessed and looked out for. But I know that all ends because it's a temporary life we live. And tragedies do strike. Christ said, I am the good shepherd. And the good shepherd gives his life for the sheep. That's your calling, that's your work in life, always, every day, constantly. But the hireling, he who is not the shepherd, he who does not own the sheep, sees the wolf coming and leaves the sheep and flees, and the wolf catches the sheep and scatters them. That little warthog comes to mind always. But he sees the wolf coming and he flees. And I ask myself, well, would I run? Would I flee? I don't want to. I hope I won't. I hope I never would. Do I want to die? No, but I hope I would never flee. The Bible does tell us that the laborers are few. And you know, sometimes, like in my case, I'm not here in Edmonton all the time. I have other flocks, North Battleford and Saskatoon. Some people as far away as Tisdale, Saskatchewan are in our churches. And Prince Albert, and I can't be there and here at the same time. That's why it's such a nice thing to know that God is there and here and everywhere at one time. The laborers are few, but if a shepherd has three large flocks and they're scattered, he has to travel from one to another, and it's impossible to ensure their safety. Now, in verse 24 of John 10, Jesus said, I told you, and you do not believe me, the works that I do in my Father's name, they bear witness of me. And the minister ought to be able to say that what he has done bears witness of what he is. But you do not believe, because you are not of my sheep, as I said to you. So I have to understand that too, that it's God who's in charge, and there's some, I can't distinguish, I don't try to distinguish. I just accept when a person talks to me or comes to me or attends with us, that they're converted, that they want to obey God, they want to follow Jesus Christ. I just accept that without any questions asked. The only thing we ask of anyone coming is they come in peace and harmony. That's all. Come to rejoice in the Sabbath, to be peaceful, to be harmonious, to laugh together and enjoy being together. And if the time comes we need to cry, then we'll cry together too, as in Ruth Roy's case. My sheep hear my voice, Jesus said, and I know them and they follow me. But you know, if you don't listen to a voice long enough, you forget what it sounds like. It's an amazing thing. You forget what it sounds like. I was married for 27 years to Joan, since she was 18 and a half years old. I met her when she was 16 and a half. I don't remember what her voice was like. I don't remember that. And I remember I gave Peggy a tape of Len's introduction to a toast to the bride, and Peggy said that to me too. She'd forgotten a little bit of what his voice was like. That comes to us, you see. That's the way God made us. If we do not listen to that voice for a certain length of time, we'll forget what it sounds like. And some people can be distracted from that voice, the voice of Jesus Christ. And you know, that voice is not wrapped up in these prophecies. They had to force Jesus almost to talk to them about Matthew 24, about those prophetic events. I give them eternal life, Jesus says, and they shall never perish. Neither shall anyone snatch them out of my hand. That's a wonderful comfort, that God holds us like this in an open hand. And it'll never be possible for Satan to come and snatch a person out of God's hand. But you know what is possible? It's possible for that person to jump out of God's hand. You see, because God doesn't hold you like this. He holds you with an open hand. And you can walk out. Satan can't come and get you. God wouldn't let that happen. But you can walk out. He gives you and me freedom of choice. So sheep can wander off. If they do not want to stay, they can wander off. But it's not what God wants. It's a pleasure for me over the years to have learned that God is in charge of our futures, of your future. And anyone who yields to God is going to have the future that God wants for him, because as Christ said, I go and I prepare a place, an office, a position, a responsibility for you So God has your name written down in his registry. He's preparing a place for you, and he's bringing events into your life or allowing events in such a way that you will learn to be the kind of a person he wants you to be, ultimately his child. So he can give you the kind of responsibilities that are good for you. That's what Pentecost is all about. The first fruits, the firstborn, the first resurrection. And I know that we are to love one another. That's one of the strongest teachings of Jesus Christ. The sign they will know that you are my disciples is that strong love you have for one another. That means that when one person laughs and rejoices, we laugh with them and rejoice with them. And when one cries and is sorrowful and sad, you cry and you're sorrowful and sad with them. We do walk together. And we have this plaque out in the front here saying, preparing a people. And I ask myself, preparing for what? Preparing for the kingdom of God, we will say. Preparing for meeting Jesus Christ, we will say. Yes. But you know, between now and then, we have a road to walk on. We have a life to live. And we have got things to face, brethren, which are not going to be pleasant. The worst time that's ever going to come upon the face of this earth will be between now and the return of Christ, the great tribulation. And we can get frightened by it. We can be scared. We can be made to do all kinds of things. And that would be wrong. I received a letter recently from a person whose close relative died, a grandmother. And you know, the person said they felt forsaken. They felt that God had forsaken them. They stood there and watched the casket, looked at the casket of the grandmother who died, an old woman. But they felt personally forsaken. Now, that was a small problem. What if it would have been a child, a son, or a daughter? Or your mother or father, closer to you, suddenly killed in an accident or dying? I knew a man, his name was Lucas. 6'4", big, handsome man, doorman at the Sheraton Hotel in Munich. Magnificent man when you saw him. All he could do is stand there and he'd give him tips all the time. Lucas died of AIDS. I baptized him 3 years before he died. And I was with him when he died. Not the other day he died, but I visited him in the hospital where I had to sit on one far end of a big room because he had infectious coughing and all the difficulty with that he was having. So I had to wear special clothing and sit on the far end of a room and talk to Lucas. That's the only thing I could do there. I would leave an anointed cloth for him. And he said, you know, Mr. Barrett, he says, I know that before I came into the church, I did a few wrong things. And one particular wrong thing he did when he went to London, he said. He got into some kind of drugs and didn't even know what happened. But he said, I repented of all that. I was baptized. I've been in the church now for 3 years. Why did God let this happen? And you know, what do you say to a person like that? You say you deserved it? What do you say to a person like that? He didn't want his family to know. His family lived in Italy, his mother and sister. Did not want them to know. How can you tell your mother you're dying of AIDS, your sister you're dying of AIDS? But I said, Lucas, it's not fair to your mother and sister. So I went to the Italian ambassador, because they couldn't speak German or English. I told Lucas, I'm going to do this. I went to the Italian ambassador, who phoned the family, told them the situation, and the sister came up, met with me and the Italian ambassador, and we went to see Lucas. And they took him home, and he died a very short time later. He felt forsaken for a while. He had to work through that. And understand that even if he was to walk into the valley of the shadow of death, he was not forsaken. But how do you teach a person like that? How do you encourage him? How do you strengthen a person like that? I remember talking to a young family a few years ago who had two little lovely children, just like we look at our little children here, little Ashley and Savannah, you know, 18 months old and 4 years old. And you know, this little family flew out of Los Angeles, and before they went on the airplane, the little boy said to his dad, we have to ask God to give us a special angel to protect us. And so that little family did, right in Los Angeles airport, just said to God to bless them and protect them. And 3 days later, both children were dead, killed in a car accident. Mother was badly banged up. You know, and the father was unscratched. And he said to him, he sat in this wrecked car, sitting there waiting for the ambulance to come. He looked, saw his wife all smashed beside him. He looked behind him a little as he could, and he saw his kids off the seat and down on the floor. So all he could see is a glimpse of them. And he was waiting, he said he was waiting for something to happen. Maybe the feeling that Job may have had, some kind of a great big comfort. Maybe God has sent an angel to tell him it's okay, or he knows, or whatever. He was waiting, he said, and nothing happened. He was very angry with God, felt very forsaken. How do you talk to a person like that? You know, I met him and his wife 6 months afterwards, and it's amazing when you think about it. You know, I cried with him. And that's what you do. That's all you can do. I remember my good friend Grover and Edna when they found out that she had 3 months left to live. You know, we the three of us, stood right in his front room and just cried together. You do that. You comfort one another. You know, I find it, when I go to anoint somebody, I find it hard to walk away and leave. If the child is ill especially. And I know some people say, well, you know, just anoint them and then go home yourself. And some ministers do that. But I find it very difficult to do that. Because I'd like to anoint somebody and see them bounce up and down and be happy and healed and just fine. And, you know, then you feel wonderful. But it doesn't always happen. It does sometimes. As I mentioned, that little girl in Ottawa, she's alive till this day and fine. But children, I find, are healed much more readily than grown-ups. But what do you do then? Can you just say, well, God will take care of it, and I'll do this work, and God will take care of the rest? Well, you know he'll take care of everything, but, you know, we have got to learn to work with one another and to have empathy for each other and a real concern and love. Let's go to Matthew 24. But it's a matter, brethren, I finally have come to understand and realize, it's a matter that I can't do it for you. I can teach God's way. I can live God's way. I can try to answer the questions, and God doesn't give me all of the answers. But I can't live your life for you. I can't think for you. I can't pray for you. I mean, I do pray for you, but you know what I mean? I can't pray in your place. And I can't put myself in your shoes. I try to, though. I really try to. And I know you try to put yourself in my shoes sometimes. If we did that, if we learned to do that, it would be an awful lot better for us, a lot easier. But in Matthew 24... we won't take this whole section, but, you know, they were asking Jesus Christ what is going to happen in the future. And he says in verse 10, many will be offended, will betray one another, and will hate one another. That's of God's people. How could that be? What do I do to stop it? I ask myself. And I find I'm pretty helpless. You know, I can't stop somebody sending out these magazines who's gotten your address, for example. And I can't stop you from reading it if you want to read it, you see? I can't prevent that. To me, it's junk mail. Because I know the attitude behind it is not a godly attitude. But I can't stop anybody, and I don't stop anybody. That's God's work. But it says in verse 12, because lawlessness will abound, the love of many will grow cold. It takes effort to love each other. You know, you husbands and wives know that, don't you? It takes effort to love your wife. And it takes an effort to love your husband. I'm not sure, maybe it takes more of an effort from the wife to love her husband than the other way around, but it takes an effort from a husband or wife to love each other. You've got to be at it on a regular basis, on a daily basis, in your thoughts and in your prayers. You know, and when I talked to Val on the phone, which I did yesterday, you know, she knows what my schedule is. She knows where I will be, when I will be there. And I know that she's prayed for that, and she thinks about me during that span of time. And she knows when we're gathered here, right at this very moment, you know, right in England right now, it's about 10 o'clock at night or 11 o'clock at night, and Valerie knows exactly where we are. And she's prayed for you and for me and for us here. That's the way you keep a person in your mind. You think about them every day. And you put those thoughts in your mind, like the Bible. You read it every day. You think about Jesus Christ every day. And then we live this way. But in verses 19 to 22, it says, woe to those who are pregnant, who are nursing babies in those days. And some people will say, well, therefore, I'm not having any more kids. That's a faithless statement, brethren. It's a belief that the return of Christ is imminent. We're not going to have any more children. So one man told me that. He thought Christ would return in 75, so they only had two children. This was a millionaire, wanted more children, never had them because of that, and regrets it till this day. Pray that your flight may not be in the winter or on the Sabbath, for then there will be great tribulation, such as not been since the beginning of the world until this time, nor ever shall be. And part of that great tribulation, brethren, is the deceptions that are foisted upon you and foisted upon me, and the things that we can't even begin to imagine. We read about the SARS problems. We read about mad cow disease. There's things that you can't imagine and I can't. I read in a Time magazine here. You know, this blows my mind. I'm not sure if you've got this edition or if you even get it. It's May 26th, 2003, Time magazine. But listen to what has occurred and happened here in this situation. There are plants. Now, we're talking about corn on the cob. Corn on the cob. I mean, I like corn on the cob. You know, we've all eaten corn on the cob. And other plants as well. There are plants that are spiked with extra genes that are being harvested for drugs. So they've learned somehow to alter the genetic code of the corn so it's spiked for growing certain drugs. And then the question is, could the wrong ones land in our food? Because this is detrimental to your health and mine, let alone the mad cow disease and all the rest of that. They go on saying, So far, more than two-thirds of plant-based medicines are being tested in corn, a plant whose genetics are well understood. But the danger of using food crops became clear last December when the United States Department of Agriculture ordered the burning incineration of 500,000 bushels of soybeans in Aurora, Nebraska. The soybeans came from a plant that was used in everything, is a plant used in everything from baby food and margarine to ice cream. These soybeans were inadvertently mixed into a silo with corn that was genetically engineered by a Texas firm called Protegene Incorporated to produce a vaccine against pig diarrhea. Just so that people could put 50,000 hogs on a hog farm and they wouldn't get diarrhea. So you grow a special corn that plugs them up, I guess. I'm not sure what it does to human beings, but I don't want it. Whatever it is, I don't want it. Drugs have side effects, says Gene Halloran of the Consumers Union. They should not turn up in our cornflakes. No, I think it's okay to have cornflakes. But anyway, you know, you really wonder. By the end of the decade, 2010, Dr. Hay had something to say about 2010, very interesting comments. By the end of the decade, biopharmaceuticals are projected to grow into a $20 billion industry. And when it comes to money of that size, I'll tell you, nobody worries very much about where it's grown. You know where the cheapest place is to grow this corn? Not in the greenhouses where it's protected and kept aside and safe, out in the middle of the field where everybody else's corn grows. And that lets it be cross-pollinated, you know, and you've got not only the danger, the guarantee that it's going to be mixed up. Anyway, but many of the new drugs will be manufactured in living plant factories. How many will remain uncertain. There has been an emotional response to the technology, says Hayat, but if we can bring down the cost of treating these diseases, the drawbacks compared with the benefits will be minuscule. It won't bother you. It won't hurt you. It'll be okay. No, this is the way our scientists go and our business goes. It's a matter of money. How much can I make? How much can I earn? How well do I do? And so on and so forth. How do you live with things like that? How do you live if you went through Auschwitz or Mauthausen? How do you help people who experience those kind of lifestyles and problems? We had a nurse in the Toronto church that has just been assigned to working in the SARS unit in the Toronto hospital. And so she's quarantined, of course. She's going to be gone for some weeks. And we were asked to pray for her that she would be kept free of SARS. Do you think some of God's people will ever die of something like SARS? Do you think any of God's people would ever die of something like cancer? Come on. You know very well it's going to happen. It can happen. You're killed in accidents. You know, rocks fall on our head or whatever. It happens. We don't believe in a rapture. Seventh-day Adventists do. Some people will say, well, God would never allow his people to suffer. But read Hebrews 11. He does. And your life and mine, we've seen it, haven't we? We've felt it, haven't you? Haven't you shed tears over things in your life? Sure you have. And if you haven't, you should, because it's going to strengthen you and it's good for you. And we have a policy in the church. We do not write letters to people in other churches and try to induce new ideas and concepts. We want people to come to God willfully, willingly, I should say. Willingly, gladly, joyfully. You know, I know that my responsibility as a shepherd is to serve God's people in every way I can all of my life, but I also realize that I'm limited in that. First of all, I didn't ask to have a church in North Battleford and Saskatoon, but I'm glad they're there. And I gladly drive over there. Tonight I'm going to be leaving, and I'll stay overnight probably in Lloydminster on the way through to North Battleford, because it's a four-hour drive. Otherwise, I have to get up at 5 in the morning. And then when you give two sermons in the day, it's a little bit dragging. So I'll drive and stay overnight in Lloydminster. I'd rather not, but I do feel I have to do that. But I'm glad those churches are there. I'm delighted they're there. And all of us are. And wherever God's people are, a minister of God is delighted that they are there. I like Paul's comments in Philippians 4, because he really puts it correctly here, and we'll close with this scripture. I've got another 2 minutes to go in the sermon, so it should fit just exactly right in that hour. Philippians chapter 4. This is what Paul says to you and to me. And you know what? he's looking at people who were facing things just as bad as you and I were. I mean, you know, the church in Paul's day went through the total destruction of Jerusalem. The Roman soldiers were after anybody who was a Jew, anybody who kept the Sabbath, in other words, you know, was fair game. And you can bet some of God's people ended up building the Colosseum in Rome, which was built by the captured Jews that came out of Judea. Rejoice in the Lord always, Paul says. And again, I say rejoice. How do you do that? How do you do that when you're dying? How do you do that when you're suffering? How do you do that when you're hurting? How do you do that when you're being maligned or your mate leaves you or your children give you difficulties? How do you rejoice? How do I teach that to people? How do I reflect that in my life? I do try to do all of those things. Let your gentleness be known to all men. That's the love that God says should be obvious. Let your gentleness be known to all men. The Lord is at hand. Be anxious for nothing. Don't worry. God is in charge. Like he says, God says, you know, I'm taking over today. This is God speaking. Don't worry. That's true. Be anxious for nothing. You know, and Lucas, before he died, he understood that lesson. And he was not bitter. He was not angry. He went through all of that. And I know other people have gone through those things as well. They faced that and they've gone through it. By prayer and supplication with thanksgiving, let your requests be made known to God. So there's a connection to God that you need to have then. A connection of appreciation and of thankfulness. The thankfulness for growing up in a beautiful place, as I had the opportunity to grow up in the Coal Branch, a coal mining town. But what a wonderful life I had there. What a wonderful life, you know. Yes, we worked hard. My brother and I took over the whole town with newspapers, delivered the newspapers all over town, did all those things. And we also were the little Germans, the little Nazis in town during the Second World War. So we were beat up from time to time and pushed around and so on until we grew up and got to be good hockey players. And then they needed us, you see, so that was okay after that. But let your requests be made known to God. And if you do that, and when you do that, the peace of God, which surpasses all understanding, will guard your hearts and minds through Christ Jesus. That's my comfort for God's people. That it is God who will guard your heart and mind so that false doctrines can come, false teachers can come, and you'll see the attitudes behind that. And it won't disturb you. You'll recognize the handwriting of Satan as though he signed the book. You'll just see it. He will guard your hearts and minds. That's a great comfort to me. Finally, brethren, and here's what God says now to you and to me, your responsibility. Whatsoever things are true, noble, just, pure, lovely, of good report, if there's any virtue or anything praiseworthy, meditate on those things. You know, think on the right things, the good things. A good friend of mine sent me a little note just the other day, and I've seen it now from two or three people, so it's going around a little bit. Good things always go around. But this is my good friend from Pasadena, Dr. Pace, that sent me this little note. I'll conclude the sermon with it. It's a Indian fable, an Indian story. An old Cherokee Indian chief is telling his grandson about a fight that's going on inside of himself. He's saying to his grandson, there's this big fight going inside of me. I've got two wolves in there, two wolves fighting in me. He says, one wolf is evil. He's full of anger and envy and sorrow and fear and cowardice and greed and regret, full of arrogance and self-pity and guilt, resentment, inferiority, lies, false pride, superiority and ego. All of that's mixed up in this one wolf. And the other wolf is good. He's filled with courage, with peace, with love for his neighbor, and with hope, with serenity, with humility, with kindness and benevolence, with empathy, with generosity, with truth, with compassion, and with faith. His grandson looked at his grandfather and said, as his old Cherokee went on to say, these two wolves have been fighting a fierce battle inside of me, son. And he says, these wolves are fighting in you too. And they're fighting in everyone. Everyone has these two wolves. So the grandson thought about what his grandfather said. And then he said to his grandfather, he asked him, which wolf wins? And the grandfather said, the one that I feed.